Alex, so nice to have you back on this podcast.
Good to join you again, Nima. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Let's get started with the current situation in Germany and what's going on with AfD and with the far left candidate in Germany. Both of them are against the conflict in Ukraine. And the question would be, how capable are they to change the foreign policy of Germany when it comes to Ukraine and the policy that the United States has toward Russia?
It's very difficult for me to say, because I think that the German people have had enough of the current government's policies. They're extremely unpopular. People are very much resentful of them. Both, you know, the German policy towards Russia, towards Ukraine, the sanctions, even things like net zero policies, the LGBT ideology, the uncontrolled immigration, all of that has been horribly unpopular, and naturally there's a reaction from the German people in the form of support for AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, which is, let's call it quote-unquote far-right. They're simply sovereigntists. They are, German nationalists, patriots. And then the left, former Die Linke representative Sarah Wagenknecht, who is also, I think, in a similar way, she's a German patriot, a sovereigntist, maybe a little bit to the left, but same thing. This reaction is out of resentment for the current policies that have been pursued even since before Angela Merkel, which are simply globalist politics. Globalist policies, as defined by the Davos set by Klaus Schwab and company, and that absolutely do not work for the people. We've had the farmer protests last year and earlier this year, and so obviously the current set of policies cannot continue as they are if the people have the say. Now, there are powerful vested interests that control German policies and politics, which will resist this to the bitter end, and so they will want to still use Germany as some kind of a bulwark against Russia, as a source of support for Ukraine, as a country that's leading the net zero carbon policies, and so on and so forth. And so they will try to somehow muzzle both Sarah Wagenknecht's party and the AfD by hook or by crook. And so I have a friend who is a relatively highly ranked member of the AfD party, who told me that they're using all kinds of scandalous tactics and strategies to destroy the AfD, to sow discord among the leading members of the AfD. The media, the police, the secret police, and the courts are all working in concert to try to weaken and destroy the AfD. But they can weaken a political party, but they cannot change the democratic will of the people. So in one way or another, this democratic will find a venue. And as we saw in France also, that both the left and the right alternative to the current government have been gaining strength, they will find a way, and the politics in Germany will have to change in one way or another. Hopefully it'll be done through the institutions of the system in a peaceful way, but there's always a risk that there be a revolution or a civil war and that things get really, really ugly.
Can we say that Germany is going on a path that their economy would force them to change their policy in Ukraine? Because right with the situation that they're having with their economy right now, how do you see that?
Yes, I think that that's going to be definitely one of the major factors that is going to give the impetus to these changes, because inevitably the standards of living in Germany are going to be going down. Well, they already are going down, and the German people can tell, they can feel it. And it's only going to get worse from here. You know, we just saw that Volkswagen, one of the largest German car makers, is looking into shutting down their production facilities in Germany and moving elsewhere. There's also, you know, I was shocked when I saw this, but there's an old industrial giant called ThyssenKrupp, which now has a negative enterprise value. So their enterprise value about 2 years ago, when the war in Ukraine started, was at around $20 billion. Today, it's negative $100 million. So who knows? Who knows how many times you might be able to multiply that? I know somebody will say, like, well, look at Rheinmetall. They're doing great. Yes, of course, they're doing great because they're getting billions and billions of euros in government contracts, and the government will pay whatever they, you know, whatever they invoice. But, you know, independent businesses, small and medium-sized companies, which have forever been the engine of German growth, their export success, their innovation, and their engineering excellence, they're going by the waysides in their thousands, and people are losing jobs. And so, you know, all these people who are now deprived of their living, of their livelihood, of their future, are going to start to create a very strong political current, which is going to pressure the governments for meaningful changes. You know, back in the 1930s, this exact cohort in the society, these jobless people who have no future, who have been deprived of a living, of ways to realize their aspirations in life, were used to give fuel to the country's militarization and Nazification. And this is clearly what the ruling establishment is trying to achieve this time around. You know, they're very close to sacrificing the last Ukrainian, so they're going to have to continue their war against Russia, you know, with the Poles and Germans and Romanians and so forth. So this is the process that's, you know, trying to generate that dry tinder for, you know, a new wave of militarization and Nazification of European nations. But I think that this time around, people are much more aware of what process is taking place and what manipulations are being implemented around them to steer them in the way of war against Russia. People now understand this. And we no longer have this big communist monster in the East. Because in the 1930s, you know, the Soviet Union was this evil, dark communist monster that's coming for us. And I think that people today don't quite believe that Russia is some kind of an evil monster that's coming for us. So all these, you know, like all these pronouncements by the leaders of these European countries and NATO and the United States and Britain and so forth, who are trying to tell us, oh, the Russians are coming to get us, we'll have to prepare for war and to fight for our wonderful liberties and our democracy. I don't think people are believing it anymore. And I don't know if, you know, most people might not recall, but when the Ukrainians captured some Russian tanks and you know, armored personnel carriers in Ukraine, and somehow then those tanks, those destroyed Russian tanks, ended up in Berlin to show the people, hey, look, you know, we killed a bunch of Russians, and here's the proof. The German people started putting flowers on these tanks and started writing messages of sympathy and support to the Russians. So the national mood is very, very different than what it was, you know, 80 years ago. So the outcome, I think, is not predictable, but unless somehow they manage to saw some new kind of mass formation psychosis in society that completely disorients the people, I don't think that the same playbook is going to work out this time. And I think that ultimately Germany will do what Germany has tended to do for centuries through history, and that is that when it's when it finds itself in a crisis and in a hostile surrounding, you know, geopolitically, it tends to grow closer with Russia. And today Germany really is in hostile surrounding geopolitically, because both France to the east, France to the west, Poland to the east, and also the Scandinavian countries are actually quite hostile to Germany, and they have been antagonizing Germany quite actively and deliberately. And so I think that this is probably going to end up pushing Germany closer to Russia, even though it is not discernible now. It's one of those thing that is still under a fatwa, under like a taboo. You cannot be friendly with the Russians. But you know, circumstances change, thinking changes, fashions change, and so I think that over the coming decade we're going to see a change in that direction.
Recently, just 2 days ago, it seems that the Biden administration has changed its nuclear strategy. They're having a new strategy in terms of nuclear bombs and nuclear facilities that they're having. In this strategy, they're calling the strategy of preemption. It seems that they would attack Russia and China if they feel that they want to attack them, because you don't know when they're one. This is so amazing that it's kind of, when you look at the whole strategy, you see something offensive. They're getting ready to fight Russia and China at the same time and using nuclear bombs. And here comes the question when it comes to Europe. Is Europe thinking of itself as a buffer zone that the United States can use it against China or Russia? Russia is much closer. And just when it goes beyond Europe, they're thinking, no, let's go find some sort of political settlement, because Europe is just devastated by these nukes. And how do you see, because there has to be something in the European Union to understand this. Because if something goes wrong in the conflict in Ukraine, in the growing conflict in Taiwan, Europe would be the main target. And do they really understand this, and what's at stake for them?
I think that most people in Europe probably understand these things, except that the political process in Europe selects for the people who either don't understand this, or they don't want to understand this, or they succumb to these, these ideological narratives that say like, oh, you know, if we play this clever, we can, you know, start a nuclear war and then, you know, survive it and emerge victorious on the other side. And I think that these very same parasitic circles also have an obsession with overpopulation. So they think like, hey, you know, two birds with one stone. We could kill Russia and we could get rid of about 1 billion people. I didn't invent that number, billion people, myself. There was, at the Pentagon, they conducted repeated simulations of a nuclear attack on Russia. And people can look up an interview where Tucker Carlson a few years ago, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, he brought a man named Harry Kazianis, who participated in these simulations. And so the idea was to launch a nuclear attack on Russian command and control centers, and to then follow up with a land invasion with infantry from Ukraine, from the Baltic states, and from Poland, possibly. And, you know, they thought that if they managed to launch a successful nuclear attack against Russia's command and control centers, that the Russians would not be able to mount a defense quickly enough, and that these infantry forces, the ground invasion, would then be able to successfully take control of Russia, of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and you know, I don't know where else. But they the estimate of casualties, if this were to be done, was a total of about 1 billion people on both sides. Now, when these monsters make these kinds of simulations, when they say that there would be 1 billion casualties, you can probably double that. Probably would be more than that. Apparently, they were not deterred by the idea, because to the very end, they have not only continued to build out these missile launch sites in Romania and Poland, they were planning to do the same in Ukraine and to place those missile launch sites in Chernobyl and in Kharkov. And so that would reduce the time for the Russians to prepare a counterattack, I think, to about 5 to 7 minutes. But with hypersonic missile, it could be down to as little as 3 minutes. This would actually preempt Russian nuclear deterrence, which means that Russia would be placed at a very severe strategic disadvantage. And in fact, I think this was one of the major factors that has caused the Russians to launch the special military operation into Ukraine, because not only were the Americans, Biden administration, Antony Blinken, were not providing any guarantees to the Russians that they would not place any nuclear missile sites in Ukraine, but that they actually said, no, we reserve the right to do this. So once Ukraine is in NATO, we reserve the right to install these missile launchers in Ukraine, wherever we choose. And they were not prepared to discuss this other than the number of missiles that might be launched from there. So this was not good enough for the Russians, obviously, you know, because it literally deprived them of their nuclear deterrence. So it would place Russia at a possibly fatal strategic disadvantage, which is why the Russians in the end had no choice but to go and to intervene to make sure that Russia, that Ukraine never entered the NATO, and that they never could become part of the Western alliance.
And right now in Ukraine, in your opinion, we had the Kursk incursion in that region, and it doesn't seem that it has failed. We know right now, we know that it has failed. But in your opinion, there are rumors that the United Kingdom is behind, London is behind these type of policies, and they want to drag the United States into the conflict even more involved. And it seems that they're feeling that Donald Trump would win, and that would influence the conflict. That's why they want to bring the United States even, they're getting the United States even more involved in the conflict in Ukraine. Do you think that before 2024 presidential election being finalized and having a new president in the United States, they're going to do something similar in that region, in this conflict between Ukraine and Russia, or we're not going to have the same kind of mindset that they're having, the same kind of mindset behind this Kursk incursion?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that the United States is having the elections in November. And so I think that from the point of view of the current administration, I think the best possible outcome for them would be a status quo. you know, nothing changed. Nothing changes. Nothing bad goes down, because anything bad happens would be probably a negative in their presidential election campaign. So it would, obviously, they're going to cheat, right? They're going to try to steal the election. But, you know, election is easier to steal if the candidates are more evenly matched. If one candidate is so desperately unpopular that nobody will vote for her, it's probably a lot more difficult to cheat in that case, and a lot more obvious to everybody else. So, you know, you get an illegitimate administration. And part of the problem with an illegitimate administration is that if Kamala Harris enters the White House after stealing the election, and she says, okay, U.S. military, I ordered to go to war against Russia, they will not go. You know, they will simply, you know, it's one thing if Donald Trump, who is popularly elected, orders military into action. A very different thing is Kamala Harris orders them into action. So that's part of the problem. The second part of the problem is that I think that the United States hasn't been quite so keen on Ukraine as Britain has been. And even during the Obama administration, when the coup in Ukraine was orchestrated, you know, there was quite an extensive campaign by the neocons and by the British establishment to steer Obama in the right direction in Ukraine, because initially he wasn't interested to deal with Ukraine at all. Obama administration's main strategic goal was their pivot to Asia, right? They wanted to make sure that they dominate the East Asia and the Pacific region, and they were not very keen on Ukraine. And Obama even reached the conclusion with his advisors that Russia, at any rate, has escalatory dominance in that region of the world. So it was very, very unlikely that they could achieve anything there by force. And so, you know, the neocons made a lot of pressure on Obama. And at the time, there were a lot of articles and op-eds criticizing Obama for not being committed enough to Ukraine to help them resist Russia and to push back, you know, after the coup. Britain, on the other hand, is, for some reason, which I think is something we could discuss for a long time, absolutely keen on Ukraine. They want to get United States involved because they themselves cannot do much. NATO cannot do much. Ukraine is pretty much finished. And then Britain's new best buddies in the region, Poland and Sweden, they're not, you know, they cannot tip the scales either. And so it's a very difficult situation. I fear that the only factor at this moment between now and November that could possibly change things is some kind of a nuclear exchange or some kind of a really, really ugly false flag attack involving a dirty nuclear bomb. And I think that these people are desperate enough that they might even try it. Now, will this come to pass? I don't know, because it's not such an easy thing to organize. You need people, you need an effective command and control hierarchy where people obey their orders. But this time, you know, the orders might come from the top. But I think there's fewer and fewer people committed enough in the bowels of the military and intelligence circles that they might not be keen on doing it, and that there might be a lot of leakages, you know, leakage of information where, you know, if they get the orders to orchestrate some kind of a false flag attack, that they will possibly, somebody will alert the Russians to it. And then, you know, as we've seen before, Russians go to the press, they say, and, you know, once it's out, once it's communicated to a wide circle of people, then you can't really do it, because then everybody understands that it's not real attack, that it's a false flag attack, and then you can't get the same effect in the after. So I think they painted themselves into a corner, and I don't see how they can do anything to get the United States involved before November. And after November, if Donald Trump won the election, I think it's game over.
Yeah. And do you see that the same kind of movement happening in Germany, just spreading all over Europe, and or the situation in each and every country would be different? Right now in France, we are witnessing that they want to impeach Macron. And do you see it as the same kind of policy or same kind of strategy, same kind of understanding on the part of the population that they want to have some sort of change, or it's something different what's going on in France from what's going on in Germany?
I would say that it's very, very similar. And I think that the effects are very, very similar, because in both cases, you see that both the left wing and the right wing alternatives to the ruling establishment are gaining strength tremendously. And both Emmanuel Macron and Olaf Scholz are leading very, 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 very weak government. I think in Emmanuel Macron's case, you could even say that it's an illegitimate government, because, you know, in July, they lost an election. Macron still hasn't appointed a new a prime minister and a new cabinet. And so I think it's not even a policy at this point. I think it's just a shambles. It's making it up as they go along and playing for time, hoping that something happens in their favor and that they could keep control over the system. But you see how in the case of France, it kind of backfired, because Macron saw that the rise of Marine Le Pen and the Rassemblement National as a big challenge to him. And so he kind of finagled to make sure that the left alternative won the election. So in the last moment, they cobbled together this Front National, which is a joint front of all the leftist parties, and then they won the election. Even though in the first round, Marine Le Pen was by far had the biggest support. And then after this left-wing Front National, sorry, how do you call it? Yeah, it's not Front. Sorry, now I'm blanking out. But okay, so this Union of Leftist Parties won the election. Then he realized that he didn't really want them in government, because he was afraid of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and he was afraid that some of the extreme left people were really extreme, and they could jeopardize the whole, you know, French system. So he wouldn't allow them in the government. First, he was making excuses that, oh, it's, you know, we have the Olympics. It wouldn't be a good thing to introduce a new government just before the Olympics. Well, the Olympics came and went. He still never nominated a new government and a new prime minister. And so in the end, it looks like he will go with Marine Le Pen. In the end, you know, the very thing that he was trying to avoid at first. And, you know, the result will be that he will end up impeached, possibly. And how the things will play out in Germany, I cannot say, because, you know, the political culture in two countries is quite different. The French are a lot more rebellious and uppity. The Germans are much more, how do you call it, conformist, and they are less inclined to protesting and to rebelling against the government. But you know, we've already seen the farmer protests last year, and they held on for a very, very long time, and you know, those grievances didn't go away. So that all is still there, and I think that we'll know how it plays out when it starts to happen. I think it's very difficult to predict, especially for the reason that the ruling establishment, the people who are in power now, don't want to relinquish power. They, you know, like just like the DNC in the United States, the ruling establishments in Europe and in places like France and Germany, they just don't want to let go of the reins of power. And you know how they say, if a peaceful revolution is not possible, then a violent one might erupt.
Yeah. And the other thing would be this new genius in the Telegraph talking about the greatest opportunity that China has right now, attacking China. China has to attack Russia. And do you understand? Because here is again the British foreign policy. They're trying to do something. It's unbelievable. When you look at this, it's unbelievable. And do you think that if these type of mindsets in the United Kingdom, they're giving just advices, there's just some sort of help to the policymakers? Because this is huge. When you see an article in the Telegraph, which is so important, and everybody all around the world, people are reading this publication, says this, it seems something really wrong with the publication, with the Telegraph.
Yes, I, Nima, I entirely agree with you. This is sad and embarrassing. And I don't know who this Eliasson guy is, but I think that this...
Allison.
Yeah, sorry, George Allison. Okay, well, yeah, he should be famous. I think that, you know, this type of mindset belongs maybe in the 18th or 19th century. Had George Allison bothered to read a little bit of Chinese history, you know, something basic, Chinese history 101, he would find that China has never really invaded its neighboring countries, with, you know, two exceptions when, you know, they attempted to invade Japan, but never ended up getting it off the ground. And that was only during the rule of the Mughals in China. So, you know, the authentic, genuine Chinese leadership has never been very interested in invading other people's countries for territorial gains. So why they would do this now against the country who is their ally and who is probably the most powerful military force in the world today, it's just very sad that such an article would even come out in the press. And it reveals a mindset that is so backward, that is so primitive and unsophisticated, that obviously it's not going to move the needle on anybody's decision making. It's not going to get the Chinese to think like, oh, isn't this a clever idea, look at this, we should hire this man. It's just a really, really ugly reflection on the British establishment, and on the people whose ideas they bother to promote. It's just, I don't even have words. It's very embarrassing.
Yeah. And when it comes to China, Russia, and BRICS, right now we are witnessing that Turkey was invited to BRICS and they're going to be there. Malaysia going to be there. More than 30 countries are asking to be part of BRICS. And when it comes to Turkey right now, we have been witnessing just 2 days ago, yesterday, there is a large protest in Turkey, majorly by the Communist Party, it seems, against the U.S. presence in Izmir, toward the policies they're having in Gaza and in support of Israel. And how do you see the way that Turkey is behaving right now? It seems that Erdogan is trying to play both sides, but at the end of the day, it seems you're feeling that they're moving toward the east.
Yes. So Erdogan has been trying to play both sides for a very, very long time. he has been the typical man who has been trying to sit on two chairs at the same time, and it never really quite worked out well for him or for Turkey. And it, you know, in the end, when was it? A few years ago, maybe it was 2016 or 17, if memory serves me right. He was rescued by the Russians from a coup attempt organized by the Americans, his NATO allies, right? So, you know, I think that he understood that it's, as Henry Kissinger had said it, it's very dangerous to be an adversary to the United States, but it's deadly to be an ally. And so, you know, things have gone badly for a while. And I think that maybe the last straw was, remember, when before the war in Ukraine started in 2022, the British were fully expecting to make Turkey part of the alliance against Russia. So it was supposed to be Britain, Poland, Ukraine, and Turkey together confronting Russia. You know, it was supposed to be like basically Crimea 2.0, with, you know, Poland playing the French part, but basically, you know, the same basic alliance. And in the beginning, the Turks did supply certain weaponry. There were Turkish mercenaries waging war against Russia in Ukraine. But I think that all this changed, and it changed, I think, partly because Erdogan understood that his alliance with the West was untenable. And it was to Turkey's disadvantage. At the same time, you know, the Russians have diplomatically played the game extraordinarily well to keep Turkey as a friend and to turn them into an ally. You know, in large part also by bribing them with allowing Turkey to become the major natural gas export hub to Europe, which, you know, is a great advantage to the Turks. And so I think that between the economic advantages, diplomatic humiliation suffered at the hands of the Western allies, you know, and also what we have to also mention is that the European Union has strung along Turks forever, you know, kind of insinuating that Turkey might become part of the EU, which, you know, a lot of ordinary Turkish people have wanted for a very long time, but then always kind of slamming the door in their face because, you know, human rights or judicial reforms or, you know, whatever. They always have a range of issues they can raise to say like, oh no, you have to improve on this and on this and on this before we can talk about you acceding to the European Union. So it's been you know, a rocky relationship in which Turkey was always placed in the role of a supplicant to the West. It was, okay, we'll sell you the F-35s, or no, now you cannot have F-35s because you're not, you bought S-400 system from the Russians and so on. So it's always, you know, they're not gaining advantages. They're being kind of blackmailed by the West. Whereas, you know, in their relationship with Russia, with China, with other countries of the Eurasian continent, the relationships are significantly more cooperative and constructive. And so I think that it was only a matter of time for Turkey to simply give up on the West and to start opening more and more towards the East. And I think that the war in Israel's assault on Gaza only just made it that much more impossible for Turks to entertain continued alliance with the West. And then you see that as a reaction on the street, with, you know, Turkish people going out on the street harassing American soldiers in Izmir and protesting against the American presence in Turkey. So, you know, I think this is like the slow process of NATO actually beginning to come apart. And I think this is something that many people were predicting for a very long time. But I think we've come to the point where it's actually happening.
The other aspect of the policy in the Middle East would be, as you mentioned, that coup against Erdogan and also the possibility of having another coup in other countries. But before going to this point, we know that if Donald Trump wins, what would be, he's not interested in the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine. He's just said, he said it, and his vice president said it, J.D. Vance was talking about it. And when it comes to the Middle East, here comes the question, how much leverage the United States has to influence the Saudi Arabia, UAE, together with Turkey? These are three important countries when it comes to their leverage in the Middle East and how they can manage the situation. Because in Saudi Arabia, the way that they're connected economically to the United States, that would be hugely in the benefit of the United States putting the pressure on Saudis.
Yeah, it's not easy for me to say this. I know that, you know, from the point of view of policy, of strategy, of ideology, I think that many of these countries have had it with the West. The West has been a great disappointment to them on many counts. But at the same time, you know, there are these economic link-ups, particularly, you know, the fact that the U.S. dollar is still the dominant reserve currency in the world, and that it's the dominant trade currency. And, you know, last I looked, Saudi Arabia had something close to $800 billion deposited with the Fed. I don't know how much they have with the ECB or with the Bank of England, but it's going to be very substantial amounts. And, you know, now it's very clear that if you're not allied, if you're not obedient to the empire, that the empire has no qualms about freezing your assets and making it difficult for you to trade with other countries, which can then precipitate a severe economic crisis in any of these countries. And then, you know, they become, you know, the regimes become unstable. They might have protests in the streets and revolutions and who knows what else. And so they have to play it extremely carefully, and they cannot just, say, okay, we don't like you anymore. We're not going to deal with you anymore. Either you're going to be doing business with us as we agree, or, you know, go do business with somebody else. They can't quite be as brazen in their dealings with the United States and Western Europe. They have to be very careful and delicate. In fact, you know, I seriously suspect that some of Saudi Arabia's projects, development projects, namely that Line City, I forget the name, but you know that big project where they're going to make a city that's like a line, a block, like a city block, but in a very long line. I think that project is part of the strategy to draw money from the West for something that's politically acceptable. You know, because if they say, oh, we want to buy S-400s from Russia, the West is going to say, no, you can't. We're going to sanction you. But if they say we're going to net zero and we're going to build this smart city and we're going to make this control grid that you can then use as a case study that will help your experiences and improve your control grid, then they'll say like, oh yeah, you know, you can draw hundreds of billions of dollars from us, no problem, and we want to know everything about it. So that's all awesome. So I think that it's going to have to be played in a very, very smart way, attempt to gain for time, because time is not on the West side. You know, things in Ukraine are going very, very badly. Things in Israel are going very, very badly. And with time, you know, it's getting more and more difficult. So clearly, these countries like Saudi Arabia and Oman and UAE and Turkey, they're all starting to look to the East for economic integrations and even for political support and security. Because, you know, this Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they are now developing security arrangements with teeth, with, you know, like with real force against what they named in their documents. This was recent, against terrorism, extremism, and separatism. And those three are exactly the tactics that have been used by Western powers to do their divide and conquer all over the Eurasian continent. So the fact that they named those three sources of risk, and that they're developing real countermeasures with teeth, tells you that they are decided to push Western powers out of the Eurasia. And so this will be very important for countries like Turkey or Saudi Arabia, which are always at risk of regime changes. And we can see that as the Western regime change playbook is now better understood and better appreciated by many, many governments around the world, I think that they're getting less and less successful with it. You know, most recent example being Venezuela, where they tried to regime change the Maduro government again, and it hasn't worked again.
Yeah. And just to wrap up this session, Alex, as you've mentioned, it seems that as time goes by, it would be much more difficult for the United States to confront China and Russia. That's why it seems to me that they're changing their nuclear strategy right now. Do you think that we're living a very dangerous time, that something big gonna happen in the near? Because the way that they're feeling this, BRICS is growing stronger. And China would not be weaker in 2 years, Russia as well. BRICS not going to be weaker. And if they want to just keep China and Russia under their pressure and just control them, they have to do something as soon as possible. This is the problem I think we are having right now. Do you think that this mindset in the United States would go along with the more aggressive policies toward China and Russia in this strategy of preemption, attacking some nuclear facilities, some nuclear areas, some nuclear facilities that they're having those bombs in that region? And that would be unbelievable at this particular moment.
Yes, I think that it's absolutely desperate. And I think that there's probably a very, very narrow circle of people who are actually entertaining these things in seriousness. In part, it might be posturing, you know, pretending, oh, look, you know, we're willing to do all this, so you have to be afraid of us. I think this is a more dangerous version of you know, one of the neocons saying about 20 years ago that the United States should just every so often pick up some shitty country and throw it against the wall, so just that everybody understands that we mean business. And then there was also in their nuclear, you know, part of their nuclear mindset, this is another Pentagon official who said, the quote comes from Scott Ritter. I don't know who it's attributed to by name, but let's say a senior Pentagon official in Donald Trump administration, who said, we want our nuclear doctrine to be such that the Russians and the Chinese can never go to sleep at night and not think that we might blow them up the next morning. So part of it is posturing. Whether there's a real intent in all that, I think that the number of people who would be prepared to do that is very, very small, because it's actually suicidal. Sure, you might be able to launch a nuclear attack against your adversaries, but you cannot be certain that you're not going to get a nuclear attack in return, which means that you might be dead by the time the bombs went off in Russia and in China. So what would be the point? And then there's this fantastical thinking where some of these strategies, you know, these geniuses in the, you know, Institute for the Study of War and those kinds of outfits.
Think tanks.
These type of think tanks where there's these, some of these geniuses who actually managed to convince themselves that a nuclear war is winnable. Except nobody can predict what will happen afterwards. Are you going to be able to stay in power? Are you going to be able to have control over your own government and the continuation of the of your administration? You have no idea what's going to happen. So why, for any reason, would you even go there? Unless we're talking about sheer desperation and a pretense that, hey, look how clever we are. Look how absolutely determined we are, and everybody should be fearful of us. And maybe then, you know, you try to prevail diplomatically because you are hoping that people will lose their nerve in their negotiations with you and that you'll be able to finagle something in that way. I don't know that that's going to work. I don't think that the Russians are naive. I don't think that the Chinese are naive. I don't think they're stupid. I don't think they're even halfway interested in giving away, their negotiating chips for fear that their adversaries are so crazy that they would launch a nuclear attack. And then I hope that they can do this under Biden administration. I don't know if the same will continue to go on under the Trump administration. Trump has made a terrible mistake by walking away from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty in 2019. I think that was a terrible mistake, and it has actually brought us to this point of maximum danger where we are now. And I think that in his second term, if he's allowed to have it, I think that they will have to negotiate a new disarmament treaty with Russia. And I think that this has to happen for humanity's sake.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Nima.
Yeah. My pleasure.